Hello, and you are listening to EcoJustice Radio, a project of SoCal 350 Climate Action. Our show presents environmental and climate stories from a social justice frame, featuring voices not necessarily heard on traditional, mainstream, or even public media outlets. I am your host, Jessica Aldridge, from Adventures in Waste. On today's show, No Drilling Where We're Living, Martha Arguello, Executive Director with Physicians for Social Responsibility Los Angeles, discusses neighborhood oil drilling, the call for a 2,500-foot safety buffer, and how community mobilization is addressing the climate emergency and ensuring public health and safety. For the past 32 years, Martha has served in the nonprofit sector as an advocate, community organizer, and coalition builder. She joined PSR LA in 1998 to launch the environmental health programs and became the executive director in November 2007. She is committed to making the credible voices of physicians a powerful instrument for transforming California and our planet into a more peaceful and healthy place. Los Angeles, California is an oil town. It is one of the largest oil-producing states in the USA. In the county of LA, there exists the largest urban oil field in the United States. Unbeknownst to many, the neighborhoods of Los Angeles are dotted with over 1,000 active oil wells, some you can see and others hidden inside fake building facades, even peppered along busy thoroughfares next to, well, maybe your favorite restaurant. One study warns that statewide, 2,425 oil and gas wells are deserted and unplugged. That means they are uncapped. They are not closed off and could very well be leaking toxins into the neighborhood. Later, we will dive further into the health impacts and how approving a 2,500-foot buffer is key to ensuring public health and safety. Today, Martha Arguello will speak to the issues around neighborhood oil drilling and how community-based solutions and mobilization is addressing climate disruption, protecting our most vulnerable communities, and building resilience. Thank you for tuning into No Drilling Where We're Living. At the time of this recording, due to COVID-19, we are all still practicing physical distancing and calling in from our respective homes. So unfortunately, we are not in our normal KPFK Los Angeles studio. So please bear with us on any sound quality issues. It is my honor to welcome our special guest joining us via phone, Martha Arguello, Executive Director for Physicians for Social Responsibility Los Angeles Chapter. Welcome to EcoJustice Radio.
Thanks. Good to see you.
Yeah, good to see you as well, Martha. Well, Martha, you are the executive director for Physicians for Social Responsibility, Los Angeles Chapter. There also exists the national organization for PSR. Explain the work of the Los Angeles Chapter and how does that interrelate to the national organization?
Certainly. So the Los Angeles Chapter is 40 years old this year, actually, and was started by a group of physicians here in Los Angeles who had been, you know, very active in the national and international movement against nuclear weapons. And they were doing, at that time in the 80s, doing doctor-to-doctor diplomacy. Actually, a delegation of physicians from Los Angeles went to the then Soviet Union to talk about issues related to nuclear weapons use, testing, and how to get us back from the brink of a nuclear war. And it was our physicians nationally who were able to, you know, use public health methods of mapping and basically did a scenario of what would happen if there was a limited nuclear strike in a major U.S. city. And basically, which rings of COVID, what it said is that there was no meaningful medical response, that if there were a limited nuclear strike, our healthcare system would be deeply impacted. And so, you know, we basically said it is not winnable. And the all along its life cycle, it's very toxic. So that was the beginnings of our organization, both nationally and here in California. I want to say that many of the physicians who started PSR, Physicians for Social Responsibility, were also in their own medical practices, in their own lives, when they were not doing the activism around nuclear weapons, were actually some of the founders of the social medicine movement. So they very early on understood the social determinants of health and were starting community clinics and working in areas deeply impacted from racism, poverty, and pollution. So we have a long history of deep concern over the human rights and public health impacts of pollution. And then the LA chapter has always been a bit of a leader in, so one of the first chapters to take on the issue of gun violence as a public health issue. So before we had studies that said violence is viral, that it spreads like a virus in a community, our physicians were looking at epidemics of gun violence in ER rooms. And in fact, I worked at County Hospital, and County Hospital in Martin Luther King is where they sent military physicians to train there because of this rampant use of firearms. And so our physicians actually many years ago were part of a lawsuit to stop the sale of cheap handguns, which were called Saturday Night Specials. So we have a long history of understanding the role of public health and the role of violence and how we can reimagine what a safe community looks like. And then 20 years ago, I came to PSR to help start their environmental health programs. And really, the idea was to begin to look at issues like pesticides, air pollution, from a public health perspective and say, you know, this is incompatible with public health. These practices, I worked for many years with Californians for Pesticide Reform. And at that time, you know, it was impossible to get regulations on pesticides because of the power of the ag industry. So really learning there that bringing physicians to engage with communities around policy battles is really powerful. And so that helped the work at PSR grow. When I came in 1999, I believe, there was one other staffer. We were two. We're 11 staff now. So we're actually the largest chapter in the country and really the most diverse, one of the only ones run by a woman of color. And so I think that's what distinguishes us. And our, you know, sometimes people forget that we are a public health organization because we work so closely with the environmental justice community. And I think that's also what sets us apart from many of the other chapters that are all doing wonderful work. Others are doing oil extraction work in other areas. You know, we work from nukes to toxics to climate change to air pollution, and some still work on gun violence.
And Martha, you grew up in Los Angeles. Why did you choose to get into environmental justice work?
Well, I've been, you know, I started organizing when I was in high school. My first job was actually as an organizer, organizing other youth within street gangs in LA. And then I ended up at UCLA and did a lot of work around public health. And then I ended up in the 80s working in Nicaragua around public health issues. And so that was a real passion of mine. I did a lot of work around women's health issues, around breast cancer, and was getting very frustrated looking at patterns of disease in low-income communities, particularly looking at, you know, I remember working on a project looking at infant mortality rates among Black women, and that the way everybody was trying to explain these was ignoring one big fact, that racism has a deep impact on health. And so I would be in rooms with researchers trying to understand, well, why do Black women get less breast cancer but die more? Why do Latinas also have lower rates of breast cancer but higher rates of mortality? Why do we have higher rates of infant mortality in the Black community that rival, you know, underdeveloped countries? So it's criminal. But yet we kept trying to say, is it something about them? Is it something in their DNA? Is it some? And I would be in rooms with professors saying this, and I'm like, this is not why. And so I got increasingly frustrated with that. And I want to work on root causes. And so I saw a job posting to work on the environment. And I'm like, I'm going to work on, because I learned a lot about chemical body burden and how chemicals end up in our bodies from the products that we use, from the things that are released into the environment. And that seemed to me the ultimate violation of our human rights to not have these chemicals in our bodies. And that sort of was the spark that led me to look at issues around environmental health. And I think, you know, because my background was in working with lots of social justice groups in LA from the time I was 15, and then I worked in the Ministry of Health in Nicaragua. So I think when I came to PSR, I thought everything I've ever done You know, I did a lot of physician training. I worked in hospitals. So it all just sort of came together in this perfect space, working with physicians and bringing them with, together with communities to actually change the systems that are leading to these health problems in communities.
Martha, briefly tell us about the oil history of Los Angeles, a rich history, for the lack of a better yes. word, right? And for our listeners that may not know, there are literally active singular wells in people's backyards. I was taking a walk the other day and I saw one in historic Filipino town behind a small fence in a backyard. And then sometimes there are these building facades and you're like, why does that building have no windows? And then it's an oil well. So can you tell us a little bit about mm-hmm. that history?
Well, I mean, I think we always think Hollywood built this town, but really, you know, oil built this town. One of the first women millionaires in Los Angeles made her money off the Echo Park fields that are part now sort of spread throughout Filipino town and through the Elysian Valley. So it's got, you know, it was built on oil, and over different boom and bust cycles, we've dug up more oil. There's, you know, if folks are interested, they should go online and see these photos of our coastline dotted with oil derricks, right? The area over by Echo Park on Glendale, there's these photos of just nothing but derricks where we now have homes and schools. And so that in the 50s, when there was a bust in the oil prices, then we switched to real estate. So that's when we started hiding them. And there's, you know, battles that were waged to move oil drilling from the coast, from the west side. Somehow those battles just hid them. Let's create buffers around them, like these, you know, these towers that have flowers on them, like at Beverly Hills. But throughout South Los Angeles, throughout Wilmington, and even, you know, when I grew up in Pico Union, there was derricks there. In low-income communities and communities of color, those things have stayed. That drilling has stayed, and over years has, you know, waned and increased. And now with new methods of extraction, we're back to drilling oil next to where people live, work, and pray.
And what are the community health impacts? I mean, if you're that close to an oil well, there has to be health impacts and risk factors that are coming from those oil and gas extraction sites.
Yes, and I want to start by saying that for many years, nobody studied this. Nobody was looking at the health impacts of living next to oil wells. And so there's not, you know, we've been collecting a lot of information and studies, but it's sort of one of these problems. If you don't look at it, then you can pretend there is no problem. But we know that there is increased emissions of benzene and many other chemicals that are used on those sites. We know from a report that was done by the LA County Health Department that the impacts are felt as far as 3 miles of those chemicals that are used. And we also know that we hear a range of acute health impacts. So an acute health impact is you get exposed and you immediately have a reaction. So some of those include bloody noses, nausea, vomiting, sore throat, dizziness, headaches, eye and nose irritation. And then when you look at the chemicals that are being used, hydrochloric acid, hydrofluoric acid, those, when you look at their impact, there's things like eye irritation, nose irritation, bloody noses. And so those are the acute ones. But we also know that there's other things that happen from this, the noise, not just the emissions, right? The air emissions, but the noises, the 24-hour operations, the buzzing sound that people hear, making it difficult for people to sleep. And so there's a whole range, you know, if your sleep is disturbed because the facility next door won't let you sleep, that has a great impact on your health, both short-term and long-term. Now what we're starting to see as more studies are being done is that there seems to be elevated risk for respiratory illness, including asthma. Many of these chemicals are carcinogens. And many of these chemicals are endocrine disruptors. And we're also starting to see some studies that show a correlation between birth outcomes and exposure to some of these chemicals. So there's a range. And, you know, what we're doing is, you know, California, Los Angeles has got some of the worst air quality. And every time we put more chemicals into the air that are carcinogens, we increase our collective cancer risk. But for those living in the closest proximity, they're exposed much more if you're within, you know, up to 3 miles. Those impacts are felt up to 3 miles. And heaven forbid there's an explosion, because there is no safe distance. If one of those things were to explode, if there is an accident, if there's a leak of any of those chemicals.
And those other elements that you're talking about, when they do these impact studies to say, oh, oil and gas can cause X, Y, and Z if toxic fumes were to get out. But then you had mentioned other things that it sounds like I don't think they would even take into consideration with those impact studies, like the noise from the drilling and this ringing that you're talking about. Are they taking those things into consideration for health and safety?
Actually, no. Absolutely no. And, you know, one of the oil sites at the Jefferson site, the community was actually able to file nuisance complaints because of those range of issues. And the other, you know, one, you know, risk assessment, I think, is a really poor tool to actually protect communities. So what they do is, like, they'll do a risk assessment about how dangerous this practice is. But most of those usually are done by industry, and they end up sort of saying there's no risk. But what we do know is what we hear from communities and the growing body of evidence and data that shows there is an impact. There's an impact as far as 3 miles. And you know what? We don't have to be pulling this oil out next to where people live. And they're doing it in communities that are already overburdened by other sources of pollution. So they tried not to take responsibility for that cumulative burden, but they continuously discount the research, right? So right now the companies will say, well, the research that you have on that shows health impact were done in Colorado. That's very different. It's like, you know, the chemicals are not different. That's like saying tobacco smoke in Colorado, I can't study it based on what's happening in LA because somehow it's different. Right, it's still got those same chemicals. So that's the kind of slippery practices that they do to be able to continue to say, oh, this is not hurting you, and to play the delay game.
Martha, you were talking about the frontline communities and the effects that they are having from being so close to these oil wells, but they're also, those frontline communities are disproportionately being affected by COVID-19, the pandemic at the time of this recording. That's still going on. So how does this pollution make them even more vulnerable to things like COVID-19?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, think about what we've been told by public health authorities. Smokers are at greater risk, but when you are living in highly polluted communities, you will have damage to your lungs from that air pollution, right? So we know that children have less lung capacity when they live near polluted sites. So there, we don't know the exact relationship between COVID-19 and the current cases, but there are now studies coming out that air pollution, close proximity to heavy traffic, is related to increased COVID risk. But think about it. This is a really simplified way to think about it. Anything that weakens your lungs, anything that gets in there, like fine particulates, whether that's tobacco smoke or it's particulates from chemicals, or think of hydrochloric or hydrofluoric, which is really acid, which are really caustic. If those are in the air, damage lung tissue. So, you know, I think that's what we're seeing. That the more vulnerable a community is to environmental injustice, the more vulnerable they are to COVID-19.
If you are just tuning in, you are listening to EcoJustice Radio on KPFK Los Angeles. Martha Arguello, Executive Director with Physicians for Social Responsibility Los Angeles, is discussing no drilling where we are living.
Martha, in previous shows on EcoJustice Radio, we have covered that oil and gas companies have denied their responsibility around health impacts by claiming that the correlation does not imply causation. How do the health studies deal with this issue and proving causation?
Well, that's actually that's a bit of an ongoing science challenge, right? So we tend to use epidemiological data, population-based data that allows us to look at those relationships. And, you know, the studies that are coming out now are pretty elegant and pretty well done that are finding, you know, a relationship between exposure and the impact. And, you know, it's the challenge is how much weight of evidence do you need to act? You know, and this is what I say when they start to sort of say, we don't have enough evidence, the correlation isn't really strong. I again go to the tobacco example, because the fight about tobacco laid the groundwork for every single battle we've had about science and the environment, from climate change to toxics and now oil drilling. And this is the playbook. So when would you have acted? In the 1940s, when you had some of the first studies that said there might be a relationship? Would we have acted when there was the first Surgeon General's report that talked about the relationship between smoking and cancer? Or the way we did, right? Until an insider gave us inside documentation that showed that the tobacco industry knew. And so that we have, you know, the executives of the industry on the floor of Congress saying, you know, being asked, what did you know and when did you know it? So the model of creating uncertainty was set then. So that's what I would say. And I think we have enough credible evidence to act. And then I think right now, you know, the LA County Department of Health Services did a pretty good literature review to look at what is the state of the evidence. And what they found is that there are health impacts up to 3 miles. There is no safe distance from an explosion, looking at the current epidemiological data that we have. And there's more studies being done. As we started to talk about this and bring up what was happening, more researchers have been doing studies, right? And they're everything from monitoring at the sites to see what's coming up to actual epidemiological studies looking at its impacts on birth outcomes, looking at cancer rates. We have one study that looked at asthma rates. And so it is this sort of building the base of evidence. And then, but what I would say that is more important is that the standard of proof that we have set leaves a lot of communities overexposed and underprotected. And so we really must change that. We talk about the precautionary approach, right? A public health-based approach. And there's a famous story in public health, the birth of public health during the cholera epidemic. And the doctor sort of figured out, like, why are there cases on this side of the street and not that side of the street? Well, it turned out that folks were getting water from a pump, and that was the pump that was contaminated. And this was before we understood germ theory, and they closed that pump and it stopped the cholera epidemic. And this is, you have to act on early warnings. And the what we now have is enough early warnings for us to act.
And then there are right now an assembly bill, and there's something happening at the city of Los Angeles level that is a form of ACT that they're trying to push out. What is a 2,500 foot health and safety buffer? So can you tell us about the California Assembly Bill 345 and what is it specifically requesting?
So AB 345 is, you know, the result of a lot of years of efforts, both at the local level and at the state level, to actually push action. And so the bill would actually establish an environmental justice program within the Natural Resources Agency on or before July 1st of 2022. And it would also force the Department of Conservation to adopt regulations to protect public health and safety near oil and gas extraction sites. And that would include a minimum setback distance between oil and gas activities and what we call sensitive receptors, basically human beings, schools, childcare facilities, playgrounds, homes, hospitals, health clinics. Those are sensitive receptors. And basically, it sets up those two processes. But what's interesting is that most regulations are not set up to protect public health. They are regulations that minimize the risk to the polluter. And this is a hugely important fight at the regulatory level to shift these resources agencies from being ones that facilitate oil extraction, because remember, LA was built on oil and California has a lot of oil. So these agencies have been about, oh, let's extract. And so their staffing and their values, all of that is about how do we maintain this versus how do we protect public health? That's a different question and requires different action. So, you know, the statewide coalition, Vision California, groups from all over the state are working to pass the setback because, you know, we have been waiting, we've been fighting for almost 10 years now in LA, and that's just too slow. It's too slow, and it's really sad that the city of Los Angeles, while it says, yes, this is a problem, has dragged its feet and moves at glacial speed before climate change to actually protect its residents. And so we had to go to the state to figure out, can the state move faster? We also think the governor can act. And everybody keeps saying, oh, this is terrible, and wringing their hands. But I see such little action on the part of government to actually protect communities. And that, I think, you know, it's unfortunate, right? That the same communities that are suffering from COVID are treated like disposable sacrifice zones when it comes to most environmental regulations. And it's not sustainable.
And just to be
clear, nor is it just.
And to be clear to our listeners, there's two different things happening here. There's the 2,500 foot buffer assembly bill 345. And then there is what's been happening at the city of Los Angeles level. And you touched upon that and the different groups. There's a group called Stand LA, which is it's coalition based, correct? And people have been organizing around this 2,500 foot buffer concept. And it's been at the city of Los Angeles council member level. The city council members have come out and said, oh, I support this. But there's this major holdup, and the city attorney is supposed to be doing a feasibility study, but then that's delayed. What's happening here? Why is the city of Los Angeles, if we have all of this support from our council members, why is there no movement?
I think it's fear, and it's a failure of imagination to be bold and say, what can the city of Los Angeles that was built on oil look like in the 21st century? And it continues to be that they think that our communities don't have the political power to make a change. But I think we are now seeing, in light of COVID, in light of the uprisings around Black Lives Matter, that our communities are tired of being over-policed, over-contaminated, and under-protected. And I just think it's also unwilling to take the risks, and we can't ignore the power of the oil industry and the amount of money that they spend on politics. And the city of LA for a long time just wasn't minding the store. For years, they were just rubber stamping permits, and the oil industry got really used to having their favorite status, that they could, you know, expand drilling, they could put communities at risk, and no one would watch them. And there's a sense that, you know, the Inglewood oil field is the most heavily regulated field in the country. We hear that all the time from elected officials. But when you talk to community members, they're like, we don't feel that protection. And we would rather what happened at Alanco, which actually shut down. When the news hit that Alanco shut down, we got calls from community residents in Inglewood saying, how did you guys do that? We want that. Not this promise to actually do the right thing, and yet, you know, 15 years into those standards, nothing has changed. And in fact, the footprint of that facility has grown.
What happened at Alanco? I mean, it was kind of a success story in essence. I mean, it's not a success story in that people are having to deal with the ill effects that and have for many years been dealing with the ill effects of that oil site. But what happened there?
Well, I think it was, you know, I always remember that's how we started working on this. I got a call from Nancy Ibrahim from Esperanza Community Housing. And they said, you know, there are these smells in the neighborhood, and our promotoras are going door to door, and they're seeing this, you know, patterns of illness and complaints. So we figured out that there was an oil well. It was called Alanco. The community, because it's an organized community, organized and created a group called People Not Pozos, which is People Not Wells. And we began, you know, they began, you know, talking to the residents, and we did a bucket brigade training so that they could do very inexpensive air sampling because nobody was monitoring the air. We would call the South Coast and they're like, no, everything's fine. And then we looked at their record of operations, and they had a really bad record of operation. And, you know, it was at the same time that there was national attention being paid to fracking. And so there was this sort of coming together of all of these things. And the LA Times did an article about that community, you know, that was above the fold on the front page. And it was during the last government shutdown. And we actually got calls from Karen Bass, from then Senator Barbara Boxer, like, how can we help? And they really helped bring the spotlight. And then Allen Co. decided to close because they got sued. The city attorney went after them, EPA went after them for their record of operation, and they voluntarily shut down, which we were sort of surprised. And now, you know, we've still, since I think that was in 2013, maybe 14, it's been so long. But we're, you know, that community is still, are they going to reopen? Are they going to close? What should happen to that site? You know, it's owned by the Archdiocese, which I might say owns a number of other sites where they're digging up oil, you know. But they've got many other contradictions as well. So, now they've got, which was really horrible. So after they shut down, then they put 24/7 monitoring. Then the South Coast Air Quality Management District was sort of shamed into action. And it was a battle. It was a battle to organize the community to make a call and a complaint when there was a smell, because they won't come out unless six people call. Right. So the community had to really come together to say, this is not what we want. This is not what a healthy community looks like. You know, not every site throughout Los Angeles is fortunate enough to have a community organizing group that's actually working on the ground. So that's when we said, you know, we could fight these individually. And that's how the coalition came together, said, no, we need a citywide response. And that's how Standing Together Against Neighborhood Drilling came together with Communities for a Better Environment, Esperanza Community Housing, Redeemer Community Partnership, Holman Methodist United, Black Women for Wellness, Strategic Concepts in Organizing and Power. So it is really, you know, massive effort of many groups. And, you know, the support we've gotten from the broader community has been amazing. And we've been able to keep the issue alive and keep pushing. But it shouldn't take this long. You know, as Pastor Saul says and Dr. King said, justice delayed is justice denied. And they are denying justice to the millions of people who live near these oil wells.
Martha, with the price of oil crashing, how do these oil companies and the city value these sites? Isn't there a higher and better use for these properties? And who determines the value of these oil leases?
Well, I mean, I think that it's based on the price of oil. And right now what you have is it's a really volatile industry. And so it's sometimes, you know, part of what happens is this company will sell to this other company, will file bankruptcy, it goes over here. So there's this, still that element of the wild, that sense of wildcatting, right, from one well to the other. And it depends on the volume of oil. So some leaseholders, well, the mineral rights owners can get, you know, a check for $100 a year, $40 a year. It depends on the volume that's being put up. What we now see with COVID has been a huge just crumbling of the price of the oil prices. And that, I think, should be a wake-up call to California. This is not a stable industry. And for reasons of climate change and air pollution and its limited supply of fossil fuels, we have to make the transition. And we should do it now, you know, before it's even more late. You know, even, you know, it's too late now for a lot of the climate change impact. But in terms of the air pollution and making communities healthier, we've got to do this now.
And what about the argument if someone says, oh, if we shut something down, there's a few arguments. If we shut it down, then who's paying for it? It's coming from our tax, but it's coming from the taxpayer's bill to be able to cap this thing, to be able to remediate the land. And then there's also the argument that if we stop drilling in Los Angeles, California, that the only other solution is for us to go drill in other foreign lands where there's less regulations, where there's more transportation costs and the footprint from that in places like the Amazon rainforest, per se.
You know, a couple years ago, folks from Latin America and Africa came to Los Angeles and they were interested because they'd heard about Stand LA and they were fighting petroleum projects in their own countries. And they were stunned. They were stunned. What we do here doesn't even happen in their countries. And so they left thinking, you have better regulations than we do? And you pull up oil at arm's length away from where a child sleeps? So I think that's a lie and a ridiculous argument. What we should be exporting is clean technology, and that's what other people want from us, clean technology, the safer alternatives. And look, so I think that they forget that they are violating the human rights of the people who live here with their lax regulation, right? Because the regulation is not preventing emissions. It's not preventing drilling. It's allowing it to continue to happen. So I think that that is a very spurious, and I don't think I said that right, argument. And it just doesn't hold water. And when you talk to people internationally, they're like, no, that's not it. And I think the other part is that we don't do full cost accounting, right? We don't do a full cost accounting of what it costs to pull up oil in terms of air quality, health impacts, none of that. So if you exclude all of those externalities, well, then, you know, it doesn't seem so bad. But when you include those and you include the issues around human rights and environmental justice, well, then this is no longer a really profitable industry. And if you were to actually hold them accountable to pay for the mess that they cleaned up, it also wouldn't be profitable, right? Because they're getting away through bankruptcy and others. They're actually using loopholes to get out from cleaning up their mess. And we, you know, one leak in Echo Park and at the Furman Street well wiped out the entire state's budget for cleanup. So unless we start holding polluters accountable for the mess that they're making, yeah, the taxpayers are going to be left with the bill, but we don't have to be left with the bill. That's a political decision.
If you are just tuning in, you are listening to EcoJustice Radio on KPFK Los Angeles. Martha Arguello, Executive Director with Physicians for Social Responsibility Los Angeles, is discussing no drilling where we are living.
Martha, before going to the break, we had mentioned some of the arguments that people use. And one last argument is about jobs, that if we shut down oil wells, all of the jobs that were associated with that oil are going to go away. And so how are jobs connected to the fossil fuel production, and how are we transitioning those positions?
Well, in the city of Los Angeles, there's about 300 jobs that are at the actual drill sites. So there's 300 direct jobs. We think that the oil industry should set up a trust fund to protect those workers for at least 5 years to transition to another industry. That second, I think we need a larger just transition strategy for the state of California to protect those workers. And I think it's important to also note that these workers may not transition into, you know, solar jobs, right? Because you want that transition to be, if you're making $100,000 a year, we want a transition where you're maintaining your salary. So we've got to figure out what that looks like. And I think there's some hope in the state of California with the new governor's recovery task force that says they want to do a green recovery. But I think, you know, for us, it's about holding polluters accountable. Certainly, if they just took their lobby profits, their lobby allocations and use those, we would actually have, you know, several million dollars, if not more, to protect those 300 workers in Los Angeles. And then that could serve as a model for the rest of the state of California. But, you know, if let's say you're in the building trades, right? There's also jobs in the cleanup of these facilities, in the rebuilding around these sites. If you think of Los Angeles, I mean, the Grove, it's one of the you know, that was an oil field that got cleaned up and is now, you know, one of the busiest malls in the country. So you could refurbish these and find those jobs in that, right? The shutting down and the decommissioning and the capping and making sure that that's all done safely, those are also jobs for the pipe fitters and, you know, all those trades that are now working within the fossil fuel industry could actually be put into what I call the restorative economy, right? Cleaning up the mess we've made.
And you had mentioned a moment ago, talking about a green recovery. There are three solution-based initiatives that you and I have talked about previously that I want to have us break down further. There's the green recovery that was proposed by Tom Steyer. There is the Green New Deal that we've talked about on this show in the past. And then there is the Climate Emergency Mobilization Office that is in the city of Los Angeles. Let's break those down. What are they and sure. How are they related?
Well, I will say that many in the environmental justice community have been working around just transition for many years. including prior to the release of the Green New Deal. And many of the ideas embedded in the Green New Deal have arisen from frontline communities. And I just think it's important to acknowledge that and respect that, because our experience with the Climate Emergency Department is that we also put many of those just transition ideas, right? How do we actually restore the harm that's been done to our air, soil, and water through much of our industrial production in Los Angeles? And then we said that most climate solutions are failing to actually close the justice gap because they are not intended to. And so even in California, many of the climate benefits from climate laws are actually going to coastal cities, not to the most impacted. So the Climate Emergency Mobilization Department was a place where frontline communities came and said, we need a department within the city of Los Angeles that can actually work across departments and break down some of the silos that make for bad policy, one. Two, we want to have a commission that actually is representative of the most impacted communities, so indigenous communities, South Los Angeles, East Los Angeles, all of these areas that are the most heavily polluted communities should be on this commission. And then we envisioned a broad community engagement process where we engage community in solutioneering, right? In identifying the solutions that bring jobs, justice, and start to restore our communities, right? Restore and the folks who are working on this, you know, worked on climate, we worked on air pollution, we worked on toxics, we worked on plastics. So we envisioned a Los Angeles and that department and that commission of the Climate Mobilization Department as one that could lead the charge about how we actually democratize our city, detoxify our economy, the materials part, and decarbonize, right? How do we actually lower emissions? And do it at the same time that we're building democracy and real people participation in everything from the budget to the policies we implement. And we were able to pass that working with Mr. Paul Koretz. We were able to get funding for general manager and funding for the community assemblies. That money got cut, and then we just fought for half of it back. We're still fighting for the rest of it because we think that the model that this department offers can help envision what actually community health and safety looks like by talking to the residents. We can talk to residents and impacted communities about what kind of jobs do you want? How do we do things in a way that's just? And also embed COVID recovery there. So recovery from COVID to climate has been sort of our battle cry around defending the Climate Emergency Department.
And just for our listeners that might not be from the city of Los Angeles, Mr. Koretz is council member, Mr. Koretz, who has
been
very extremely supportive of climate action proposals and ordinances in the city of Los Angeles and helped form this office and was pushing very hard for its formation. Mm-hmm. And then the funding is the budget. So the city of Los Angeles budget has been under major scrutiny over the past few months. We talked about it in our last episode, one of my last episodes with Reverend Eddie Anderson, talking about the people's budget and what that means as well. Mm-hmm. And then you had just talked about that recovery following the COVID-19 and how that is interrelated with the Climate Emergency Mobilization Office. But then there was a thing that we had mentioned called the Green Recovery with Tom Steyer. So is that connected to that idea of recovery after COVID-19?
Well, you know what? Not as much as it should be. And I know, you know, there is nobody, there are, I don't think there's any city mayors on the Governor Newsom's recovery that Tom Steyer is the president of, and he said he wants this to be a green recovery. So I think there needs to be, you know, much more communication and coordination and talking to cities about where the innovation is at the city level. The process that Mr. Steyer is leading, I think, is important for us to watch because it could be, you know, a great thing or a bad, or it could have, you know, if we are not at that table, things will end up happening in our community. So right now there is no environmental justice representation on that committee. And I think that was a real misstep on the part of the governor and to not talk to the folks who actually have the solutions. and who are mobilizing and organizing in their communities.
And what is meant by green? Because you and I, we you know, live in this community, this world, but it's kind of like this generalized term. There's a lot of greenwashing around it. Like, what does he mean by green recovery?
I don't know. I don't know what he means by green, right? Sometimes you hear them saying things and it sounds great, but I think the proof is in the pudding and what is green, right? And I think that it's going to take activism on the part of our communities to make sure that we're saying we're watching you and you need to go further, because usually for political reasons, there's also a lot of oil industry people on this committee. So there's going to be a lot of, you know, tension in that commission about what is green, what's a just recovery. And so I think that's not a people's plan by any stretch of the imagination.
Yeah, and I would assume that they're really talking about really honing in on the economic recovery following COVID-19 and how that looks. And so hopefully, I mean, fingers crossed that green recovery means economics and people and health and social justice.
I think that the only way that's going to happen is through people power and sort of us, you know, demanding that they do better, that this current extractive economy has not worked out for our communities. It is not building wealth in our communities. And it's so if you do more of the same, you will have more of the same. So I think COVID has shown us, right, that the least protected workers are actually essential workers, right? And so, you know, I just think this is, you know, it is such a flashpoint to show us all sort of how intricately tied all these injustices are to how we do economic development, right? We've got huge concentrations of wealth in this state. And unless those things are unraveled and you figure out how to make sure that Black and Brown and Indigenous people can resilient systems that work in our communities, we will still be vulnerable and we will still be destruction, or how essential workers and others are being sacrificed now in the name of reopening.
So if you have a city or a town or just people, individuals who are like, I really like this idea of a climate emergency mobilization office. And I don't think we mentioned it before, but it's the first city to have a climate.
Berkeley has one. Yeah.
Oh, they have one.
Yeah. I think they passed an ordinance. I think we're the first to actually get the department sort of kind of right. Cause we don't have it. That's how it always works. It's like, I want a victory to be a real victory.
Exactly. So for those cities, for those towns that are like, I want this kind of office, what would be your advice to them to get this rolling so that they can implement something similar in their own area to protect their own communities and environment?
Well, I think, you know, bringing together the frontline communities, doing the organizing work so that you have the right voices at the table that are deeply committed to justice, that will do the hard work of figuring out who bears the benefits and burdens of different policies. And then, you know, it's going to be a fight, because right now, you know, the approach that cities are taking to climate is, a sustainability plan. And we're going to, you know, do this by 2040 and do that by this year. And I think those, you know, we're not actually significantly reducing emissions. And so we've got to do a much better job, and that should be community driven, and it should. And then you have to find a champion at the city council level. So, you know, it takes some work doing. And I think the most important part is figuring out who else will work with you to fight for bringing you rights to how we do city planning and sustainability plans. Because those, you know, to me, the word sustainability, I don't want to hear it. I got no patience for that, because I grew up in a poor neighborhood, and I'm hanging on to this where I'm a renter, and I'm hanging on to where I live. It's really gentrified. And so I feel like we don't have a lot of time anymore to just, you know, not be bolder than what we are. And so I think you know, that the commission that we created is part of the Climate Emergency Department. That is also really important, so that you got somebody watchdogging the department, that people watchdogging that department that are impacted. And without our voices, the policies just don't work. You know, we've got lead abatement programs that have figured out a way that, you know, give homeowners and building owners a way to repair their houses, to remediate the lead. They have to commit to keep their tenants there so they won't gentrify. It's possible if you actually think about the needs of low-income people first. And I just, it's frustrating to me to see, you know, just how much we failed to center our policies on the people most impacted. So I really, you know, our department hasn't started working yet. So we have a lot of hopes and dreams for that department. We'll be at it for a long time, as all battles, right?
And the department might not exist yet, but I think the people who are all in have helped with the overall program have definitely been working very hard, including yourself, to make sure that the right voices are represented. With the 2,500-foot safety buffer, health and safety buffer, to ensure that it's implemented in the city of Los Angeles, as well as the state of California, and we have a couple minutes here left, what are the next steps that we as a community can take to ensure that this happens, and how can people stay informed?
So they can go to our website, standla.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at StandLA. And what I would say is, you know, right now the ball is in the court of the city attorney's office. He needs to finish the report on the legal analysis of the setback. And I think that the other part is, I think, you know, Mr. Buscaino, Councilman Buscaino, has the largest number of oil wells in his district. He also is a member of the South Coast Air Quality Management District. So I think people need to contact them and say, we need the setbacks and we need that now, no more delay. And the, you know, we've never let up creating the sense of urgency. But right now, in particular, people are saying, you know, I've got to work on COVID, or, you know, I'm dealing with the uprisings. And so this is on the back burner. And you got to walk and chew gum at the same time. You've got multiple crises that are all coming together and solutions that are similar. We're asking, you know, the city to divest and reinvest in a number of areas, from, you know, supporting the demands to defund police. But also, we want to reimagine what healthy communities and safety looks like. And part of that reimagining is, we won't have things that explode that make profit for someone else in our communities, right? Those oil wells don't need to be there. We have safer alternatives. And our research shows that actually the transformation of those can really bring economic development to those neighborhoods. So just think it's time to be bolder and be a bit braver, and to say to the oil industry, we're done with you.
And for those that may not know, Councilmember Buscaino's area is what we call the Harbor area, which is Wilmington, San Pedro. It's, you know, a lower income community. It's a gorgeous community. And so that was the area that we were just speaking about in regards to that. And then just making that connection, like with the city council members saying, okay, well, we have the uprising, we have COVID-19 that we need to focus on. But there's all those correlations, right? Like the reason why we are in the streets is to say we're done with these social and environmental injustices. We're done with environmental racism. We need the right jobs. We need support of our communities. And this is all completely interconnected. The fight for social and environmental justice, it's difficult. And the victories are very long sought. What would you say to encourage community activists, to new community activists, us older community activists, just say to us to say, hey, keep going. You're doing what you're doing it right.
You know, I've been an activist since I was 15. You know, I grew up in Pico Union and watched, you know, the civil rights movement. I remember, you know, I was a child when the Watts riots happened. I was you know, working at UCLA in 92 and have been part of this social justice movement. And I think right now is this moment of reckoning and moment of opportunity where we can ask for things that have never been possible. And so this is the moment to do more, right? To do all kinds of activism, from doing your online activism to actually, you know, going into the streets safely when as needed, because the only way things have changed is significant pressure from people. It is that people power. It is, you know, when we are unflinching and unwavering in our ability to speak truth to power and say, no, you cannot continue to do this to our communities, whether it's police brutality or the brutality of digging for oil next to where we breathe. All of that is, so it's exciting to see this moment in our long trajectory towards bending the arc bending the arc of history towards justice. And so we cannot, I think this is the moment to bring more folks into the activism. And now it's kind of easy. In some ways, it's been easier. It's easier to get meetings at council people because it's a phone call. There's, you know, so there's so much more you can do, but it's about making your voice heard.
And I think one of the other words that you mentioned to me, be bold. So we are at the end of our show here. How are some ways that people can get in touch with you? You know, where can they find the information for PSR? Maybe on, you know, website and social media and stuff like that.
So our website is PSRLA. Social media is also at PSR. I'm on Twitter. I'm not like a huge Twitter user, but I'm at Martha Dina PSRLA. And all of those, and then Stand LA. You can also find out about what's happening with the oil drilling campaign. There's also the website for Vision California. That is the statewide coalition that's working on oil drilling. And that's vision-ca.org.
And we will put links to those, that information, on the blog posts and the posts for these shows as well, right, so that people can get in touch with you.
Great.
And well, thank you, Martha. This has been an amazing show.
Thank you
so much for being on the show today.
Thank you.
Thank you to our guest today, Martha Arguello, and thank you to our listeners for joining us. This has been No Drilling Where We Are Living. Please connect with us on social media at EcoJustice Radio, SoCal350, and Adventures in Waste, which is my nonprofit. And if you like what you heard and you want others to be informed, subscribe to the podcast and share the episodes. You have been listening to EcoJustice Radio, a project of SoCal 350. The show can be found on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, SoundCloud, and at ecojusticeradio.org. Created by Mark and JP Morse, executive producer Jack Eye, engineer Blake Lampkin, interview hosted by Jessica Aldridge from Adventures in Waste, and original music by Javier Cadre. And until next time, remember, the power is yours.